AOPA presents Never Again, true pilot stories from the world of general aviation. In today's episode, if lights, landmarks, and even buildings disappear and then reappear, you might be scud running. Ride along in Scud Running the Hudson by Ben Moses. It was a clear and beautiful Friday night in May as a work colleague and I lifted off Teterboro's Runway 1 for a short trip to Schenectady, New York, his home. A non-pilot, he got his first look at the stunning skyline of Manhattan off our right wing as we climbed north, and his mouth dropped open. He was an auditor for the large international company I worked for, and after the annual two-week deep dive into my division's finances, he had just given us a clean bill of health. He talked about taking a bus the 130 miles up the Hudson River home, but in my relief and gratitude at getting a clean report, I offered to fly him up. Besides, I love flying around New York City at night. For me, there's not a more beautiful nighttime panoramic scene in the world. Minutes after takeoff, practically the entire East Coast became visible at 7,500 feet. It wasn't long before we could make out Schenectady and Albany on the horizon, still 100 miles away. Between my occasional exchanges with radar, my passenger and I chatted about the joy of flying, greatly enhanced by this Cavu evening and silky smooth air. He marveled at the beauty of my panel, lit just enough by dim post lights, and the strobes beating time with some imagined Beatles tune, he thought. By the time we squeaked onto the pavement at Schenectady County Airport, my new friend was determined to begin flying lessons tomorrow. We said goodbye and I taxied out for the return trip, expecting to get home in plenty of time to have a late dinner with my wife back in the city. In solo reverie now, at 6,500 feet, I clicked on the wing leveler and basked in the vista before me, the cities and towns shining bright on either side of the dark snake that was the Hudson River. I passed Kingston, halfway home, and flipped the number 2 radio to Teterboro's ATIS. Nothing had changed in the 90 minutes since we'd left. Cavu, light wind. I began trying to make out the Empire State Building, 60 miles away, when I noticed a faint red and green light in the dark off of my right wing. Must be a distant radio tower, I thought. But red and green together? What shows both red and green lights? Either something coming toward you or something going away from you. But which is it? I couldn't remember. And I couldn't see my own wingtip lights to check. Was this as yet unidentified flying object closing on me or flying away? Is it a reflection on my window? I turned all of my interior lights off, and it was still out there. I decided to turn toward it, but after several minutes, the lights didn't get larger. It must be something very far away. I turned back toward New York, still keeping an eye on it. 5 minutes later, it was still there, still directly off my wing. I was flying at 120 knots. Even something far away would have moved slightly. Then the mysterious red and green lights suddenly disappeared. And in the same instant, the entire beautiful East Coast display ahead of me disappeared. One moment I could see for 100 miles, and the next I was swallowed up in gray cloud. What the heck? I cranked the wing leveler into a 180 and got out of the stuff, thinking it was small enough for me to descend and get under it. But it was all the way down to 2,000 feet and all around. Where did this come from? Horizontal visibility was less than 10 miles now, too. From Cavu to this, in seconds, it boggled my mind. I saw Poughkeepsie's Hudson Valley Airport 5 miles away, on the east side of the Hudson. Having no choice, I headed for it, dug up the tower frequency, and called. I hope they had a hotel nearby. I landed and tied down, still in shock, as I was directed to a motel across the street. I checked in and called my wife. "Just glad you're down safe," she said. The next morning, I woke up to nearly zero weather. I wandered over to the pilot's lounge and called flight service. "Wasn't forecast, just popped up, very strange. Blankets the whole East Coast, isn't going to burn off until late afternoon," I was told. I was afraid to ask where it came from. No matter, this not-yet-instrument-rated pilot was stuck. I had 20 hours logged toward my instrument rating, and this would be a perfect day for a 25-minute IFR flight home. I hung out at the airport most of the day, fueled the airplane, and checked weather every hour. 600 feet and 1,700 feet and 2 miles. Arg. The snack machine supplied my lunch, candy bars, chips, and peanuts, and sodas. And then at 3 p.m., I called again and heard Poughkeepsie 1,003. VFR. Well, technically, anyway. How about Teterboro? 1,003, but would close up again closer to sunset. I'm going. I can fly straight down the Hudson at 500 or 600 feet, lift up a bit over the Tappan Zee Bridge, whose tallest towers are at 419 feet MSL, and slide into Teterboro a few miles beyond. Totally legally, I think. I thanked the FBO crew, jumped in the airplane, and got out of Dodge as fast as I could. The Hudson was right there, and if I flew straight down it, I'd be safe from obstacles. The plan started out great, and then soon deteriorated as the river narrowed and took some crazy turns. I slowed to 90 and extended flaps. With barely 3 miles visibility, I had to make a quick decision when the river abruptly disappeared, and I was staring at the Palisades a quarter mile ahead. Which direction did it go? My chart didn't help. It wasn't detailed enough to trust. Neither did the wing leveler. It can't turn me steep enough. I switched it off. I didn't plan for this. I slowed down, held my breath, and guessed each turn, sensing for an opening to the left or right as I sped down the river, still more than 100 miles an hour and 600 feet MSL, less than that above the water. Finally, the river straightened out and widened, but the ceiling had now lowered to 700 feet. I descended to 500 and kept flying. The Tappan Zee Bridge appeared ahead 2 miles or so, but as I approached it, the ceiling lowered again, and now I was at 400 feet, a mile and a half away at 90 knots. That's barely more than a minute. The tops of the bridge towers were in the clouds, and I pitched up, shoving the throttle to the wall. In 10 seconds, I was in the clouds and completely on the gauges. Being halfway through my instrument training, I'd been flying under the hood for several months now. I could do this. I climbed to 1,200 feet, flipped on the wing leveler, and called LaGuardia Approach, reporting my location, my intention to land at Teterboro, and, by the way, I'm in the clouds. I squawked ident. "Do you need to declare an emergency?" was LaGuardia's first question. "Can you maintain control? Do not make any abrupt turns. Do not reduce power. Trust your gauges. We'll be turning you into LaGuardia." And then, "Delta 746, be prepared to make a 360 for emergency traffic." "No, no," I insisted. "I have control of the airplane. I've got a wing leveler. I'm working on my instrument rating currently. I'm okay. Just take me over Teterboro and let me down. I'll be all right." The controller wasn't convinced. He tried to turn me towards LaGuardia, but I wasn't having it. The last thing I wanted was to land at LaGuardia, screw up all their traffic, and spend the rest of the day explaining to the FAA why I was legal until I wasn't. The controller relented cautiously and talked me through controlling my airplane very slowly and precisely. He could see my speed, altitude, and track steady, and after a few moments, I heard his voice begin to relax. Fly heading 185, I'll take you over Teterboro. And then, Delta 746, cancel that last request. Proceed on course to runway 31. Runway 31. He was probably more relieved than I was that I was in control of my airplane. He would have had to stop a heck of a lot of busy aircraft to land me on the closest runway, 13, the wrong way. I didn't fly in the clouds more than another 5 or 6 minutes before the controller told me I was over Teterboro and should carefully make a circling descent to 800 feet. I broke out at 1,000 feet and he handed me off to the tower for landing. Tower had a message. When you're parked, I'll give you a phone number. The common eye wants to talk to you. The common eye was officially the common IFR room at JFK. Uh-oh. I was safe, but my ordeal wasn't over. I braced for the interrogation. Would I lose my certificate? I parked, grabbed a cup of coffee, collected myself, and called the number from the pilot's room at the FBO. The weather at Poughkeepsie and Teterboro was VFR, I told them. I figured I could make it down the Hudson, but the ceiling closed up on me, and I didn't want to run into the bridge. There was a long pause while the FAA voice on the other end checked the weather reports, and then, "Okay, glad you made it. Be careful." I breathed for the first time in 30 minutes. And that was it. That was the only time in 50 years of flying that I ever tried scud running. How simple that flight would have been with an instrument rating. I got mine a few months later, and my commercial and multi-engine after that, because I wanted to be the safest pilot I could possibly be. Flying has given me a lifetime of joy ever since, and I've flown all over North America for more than 3,000 hours, and I've never seen a UFO. Or maybe I have. The Never Again podcast is brought to you monthly by AOPA, the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. You can find more Never Again stories online at AOPA.org by typing Never Again into the search box. While you're there, check out the AOPA mobile app, as well as the many free training and safety courses from the Air Safety Institute. Find all of this and more at AOPA.org. The Never Again podcast is produced by Royce Earle. Thanks for listening. Fly safely.